From the Sky News Centre at 5, judges are recommending that media and other interested parties be allowed to take part in injunction hearings. It's one of the guidelines suggested in a year-long review into the use of the orders. Debate has been raging over whether celebrities have a right to privacy. Imogen Thomas was named over an affair with a married celebrity. Publicist Max Clifford says it's not fair that he kept his anonymity.
He then took out an injunction which kept his private life private and protected his privacy while naming her. She couldn't afford to take out an injunction to keep her name out of it. So there's one rule for the rich and another rule for the masses.
Five British soldiers shot dead in Afghanistan by a policeman they were working alongside were unlawfully killed. The coroner for Swindon and Wiltshire gave the verdict after a four-day hearing in Trowbridge. A man who sped along a pavement in Rochdale, knocking people over as if they were Skittles, has been jailed indefinitely. Bolton Crown Court heard Lee Anthony Bradley was high on drink and drugs when he got behind the wheel last October. Gordon Brown denies he's pitching for a job as chief of the International Monetary Fund. The departure of Dominic Strauss-Kahn from the IMF has opened up one of the most senior jobs in finance. The Queen has left Ireland and is flying back to the UK after a symbolic four-day state visit. After touring a market in Cork City, the Queen made her first walkabout, crossing the street to shake hands with spectators. Some there could only see the Queen via a huge TV screen because of security, but they were still happy.
Very excited. I came 40 miles to see the Queen today.
I think she's very relaxed. She looks very comfortable and I've never seen her smile so much.
Tears of joy. We're so delighted. Tell her we love her.
And Hugh Grant and Oscar winner Colin Firth turned their on-screen rivalry into a real-life battle over Bridget Jones last night. The actors fueled a bidding war at a charity auction for a walk-on part in the next movie about the bumbling singleton. It eventually went for £55,000. That's the latest.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and I'm joined this week by the new councillor for St George West, just crowned leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council, Peter Hammond. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, BCFM's Steve Sattan reports on yesterday's McNulty report on the future of Britain's railways. And IMF boss Dominic Strauss-Kahn was arrested in New York this week. But is his alleged sexual assault on the chambermaid really the opening shots of a battle between the dollar and the euro? Well, I may regret it, but I'm also going to let Martin Summers off the leash after six and talking about the Israeli-Iranian tension as the centrepiece, taking a long, hard look at Syria, Iraq, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia and the so-called Arab Spring to the west, then moving over to discuss the wars in Afghanistan and the world's only nuclear-armed Muslim state, Pakistan, to the east. Plus, we hear from the British freelance photographer who was running around the streets of Cairo during the Egyptian coup. Or was it a revolution? I'll be asking Martin about selling the philosophy of war and the effect here at home. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and a little rain. This weekend, 16 Celsius up to fairly sunny on Saturday, but a little wetter on Sunday. Next week, highs of 20 Celsius, sunny midweek, wetter towards the end of the week. And next weekend, that's the 28th and 29th of May, highs of 13 Celsius, so cooler, fairly wet though, with some sunny spells. Definitely does sound like April rain this May, doesn't it? That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And with me is the new councillor for St George West. As I said before, he's just been made the leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council, Peter Hammond. Hi, Peter, and welcome to Drive Time.
All right, Tony, nice to be here.
Peter, you were voted out a few years ago in Southmead, weren't you, when you were Labour group leader? So the voters have actually said, actually, Peter, we don't want you as a councillor in the city.
Well, actually, I was deputy leader of the Labour group when I was thrown out, so that's... just an interesting factual question.
So how have you managed to come back in again? The voters actually voted you out at that point, didn't they?
Well, you have to cast your mind back. Of course, that was the height of the expenses scandal in Parliament. And bluntly, anybody in the Labour Party who were accused of being, we say, some of the worst offenders was going to suffer a backlash against that. So if I thought I'd have done anything wrong to deserve my dismissal, I'd be more upset than potentially that I was. But
so how did you manage to steal a march on Helen Holland, who we had on here a few weeks ago, and at the time she was leader of the Labour group? So how does that all work? How did you manage to pinch the top job from Helen?
Well, there's a lot of sort of mythology around, you know, the issues about who leads political parties. Certainly as far as the Labour Party is concerned, there's a vote every year. So there's nothing of great sort of conspiratorial significance over that. Perhaps it's just a difference in style that my colleagues in the Labour group wanted to see. But certainly Helen played a very important and very significant role as leader of the Labour group leading up to our successes in the election on the 5th of May.
So tell us a bit about your background. How did you get into politics and why the Labour Party?
Well, I've got a sort of mixed background. I became interested in politics just generally as a youngster. I was fascinated by, you know, how things worked and who were these people who were councillors, what was an MP, etc. So I was always interested. It was just something that appealed to me. But I first did something when I was at school. I'm of a certain age. I'm nearly 60. But when I was young in my teens, it was lots of school student activism, and that's how I first became involved in interest in actually standing for things or getting election. And I moved on from there. I was 18, about a year or so later, and I voted for the very first time in the general election in 1970, and after that I voted in every single election that I ever had the chance to vote in, and I just developed an interest in, you know, what I was concerned about. But fundamentally I joined the Labour Party first of all because I had a lot of friends who were members, but secondly I was very interested in trying to give people a voice, and I wanted to change things. So that was my fundamental sort of driver in doing it. I was realistic enough at the time to recognise that, as far as I could see, it was the Labour Party that was going to be the machinery of change. So I've been in the Labour Party ever since.
And what about professional work? Because you were saying just before we came on the air that you were used to work for British Rail.
Oh, many, many, many years ago. I worked for them for 17 years and until about 1990. I worked in the civil engineering department. And then I left. I left the railways altogether and became a mature student at UWE, where I was for 3 years. When I left there, I got a job working in trade union education. My profession, I understand when I look at my job description, is officially I'm a college lecturer. I never would have dreamt when I was 18 or so that I'd end up as a college lecturer, but I have, because I've been interested and involved in trade unions as a member, as an activist. And so I after I left university, I got a job working for a trade union.
Are you from Bristol, and are you a family man? Because, I mean, some people think that matters in politics.
Well, I always think that you've got two sorts of Bristolians. Bristolians by birth and Bristolians by choice. I'm a Bristolian by choice because I came here, as it happens, to work on the railways. So that's my history. I've been here nearly 40-odd years, so I'm almost an honorary Bristolian in some people's minds. Yes, I am married, and I've got a stepdaughter who's at the City of Bristol College.
OK, Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist, is with us too. Martin, we've seen this week news that family bills, this is just actually from the Daily Mail from Wednesday, family bills up £54 a week in 6 months. This is massive amounts of money, and what's happening is all families and individuals right across the country are finding that their pay is being frozen, and yet their basic utility bills, energy and food bills and things like this are going up. This we're told here exactly £54 a week in 6 months.
That's on average, of course. Some people are doing very well, as they always do. Other people are doing a lot worse. So £54 on average doesn't give a flavour of what's really happening across the spectrum of the demographics.
I mean, this is driving many of us into the red, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, the fact is that inflation is high, even though the economy is stagnant, and that's a rather poor prognosis. If the economy is stagnant, you should expect prices to be falling or stable. Prices are still rising, and therefore there's pressure, not much pressure, it has to be said, but pressure for interest rates to rise. Now, if interest rates rise, of course, that then pushes the economy further down into the hole. So it presents Chancellor Osborne with a pretty serious dilemma. but I don't suppose he cares that much. He's forging ahead. He thinks he knows best. I don't think he does.
So, but when interest rates go up, surely this is actually quite good for some people who've got savings, isn't it? Because it means they're starting to get a return on their savings, and there's more and of an encouragement people to actually save their money.
We've had a zero interest rate policy in Britain, relatively speaking, over the last few years. In Japan, they've had it for nearly 15 years. But ultimately, of course, it's a stopgap measure. You need positive real interest rates if capitalism is going to work. But they can't get to positive real interest rates without crashing the economy. That's how fragile things are.
So what is this going to mean when interest rates start to go up, predicting it will?
It's a potentially you're going to get a crash, basically. That's what's potentially going to happen.
And what will that mean?
Well, that means that the banks go back into intensive care, and we wonder what the hell we're going to do about it.
Are they going to come and ask for another bailout then at that point?
They can ask, but there won't be any money to pay it out, so that will then present a very serious dilemma to whoever is the Chancellor when it happens.
But, I mean, surely the banks can come up with some money from somewhere. I mean, these banks, the private banks, they can print money out of nowhere, can't they?
At the moment, many of them are showing paper profits, but that is because they're not being forced to market their junk that they've got in the bottom drawer. Basically, they are all bankrupt, but they're being allowed to trade. And because they're being allowed to trade, they can show a paper profit, which means they can pay out the bonuses, they can pay off the shareholders. That shouldn't really be happening. The state should be stepping in and saying, no, we're taking over this situation. But what we're trying to do all over the world is resurrect the private banking system. But the private banking system is, in fact, dead.
Okay, Martin. Peter Hammond, the new Labour Group leader on Bristol City Council. I wonder if you could explain to us how this has all worked. Because the Liberal Democrats are still in charge, even though they don't actually have a majority of councillors anymore. The actual figures are 33 Liberal Democrats, 21 Labour, 14 Conservatives now, and 2 Greens on the City Council, which means that actually, if you had got together with the Conservatives, you could have actually elbowed out the Liberal Democrats.
Thereby lays the root of the story. There is no possibility of the Labour Party cooperating with the Conservatives in the same way as there's no possibility of us, you know, you could theoretically have aligned yourselves with the Liberal Democrats and formed an administration. They are both partners in the coalition. They both have totally different political outlooks and political philosophies from the Labour Party. And we fought an election in opposition not only to the Liberal Democrats as the main party on the council, but obviously in opposition to the Conservatives. There is no common ground between us, and there is also a point that we would have been portraying the people that voted Labour for a Labour administration. Ironically, just because of the electoral system we have here in Bristol, where we only elect councillors by thirds, had there been a whole council election, i.e. all 70 seats up, it's highly likely that on the Tuesday just gone, we would have been appointing a Labour administration, because we would have won on the basis of the votes that were cast on that day on the 5th of May. We would have had a majority of somewhere between 8 to 10 seats over all other parties combined. But it's the electoral system that has prevented that from happening. So we have to carry on and oppose and hold to account the administration that we have. Based on the number of seats, the realistic position is there was no prospect of us coming together with any of the other parties. It was totally unrealistic. We did run a minority council administration when we were the second largest party a couple of years ago, but with 21 seats we just couldn't do it.
But I mean, we have the Conservatives on here quite regularly, the Liberal Democrats on here quite regularly, and they're quite often falling out with each other. In fact, many would say that over the Parks sell-off programme that Lib Dems were pushing through last year and earlier this year, the Conservatives have been the biggest thorn in the side of the Liberal Democrats. Don't you think it is possible for you to put these party differences aside sometimes to actually take the city forward and maybe not be quite such a purist and go into a coalition?
It's a question of practical politics, I'm afraid. There is no fundamental area of agreement between us and the Conservatives. We fought a campaign opposing the way in which the Liberal Democrats had brought about cuts in Bristol and the choices that they'd made to, you know, affect people who we thought were particularly vulnerable. The truth of it is that if the Conservatives had been there, based on the position that they take nationally, they would have actually introduced more cuts. There's no way that, you know, people who I represent in St George West who voted for me would want me to do a deal with the Conservatives who came in a very poor position, for example, in St George West.
But as someone who's been involved in a minority administration, how is it all going to work for Barbara Jenk and her colleagues without actually having majority on the council? Are they going to be able to run things, or is it going to be a bit of a sort of quagmire and a stalemate for them?
Well, it won't be a quagmire and a stalemate. First of all, if they bring about, if you like, the understanding that between us that allowed them to form a minority administration. But the way the system works is once you're in the cabinet, you've got a lot of power and authority, and you can only be challenged over certain things by the full council. That's the system that the government has set up for us. And so they are accountable to the full council, and they theoretically could be removed by a vote of the other three parties coming together. How likely that is very difficult to know, to predict for the future.
We've got 2 years of this particular administration. So what concessions did you manage to squeeze out from the Liberal Democrats to in order to give them this control of this present administration, albeit minority?
Well, there were a number of concessions that we got. The first and most important one is to halt the sell-off of, you know, our bits of parks and open spaces that they were pursuing. That's part of the understanding that we have. They have agreed to halt the sale, and they've also agreed to refer the whole matter back to a sort of cross-party, three-party sort of discussion and mechanism to re-look at the strategy. But the outcome of that strategy, I'll make this commitment, you know, here and now, if they revert to trying to sell off those parks and open spaces again, we won't let them. That's the first concession. The second one is, your listeners will probably be aware of some of the issues around the town green issue down in Ashton Vale. One of the, if you like, conditions placed on them is that the council needs to resolve its position within a month of the council meeting. That process is in stage now, because whatever your viewpoint on the issue is, some sort of clear direction needs to be taken by the council, because it can't hang around as it's hung around for months now. So that's the second one. Third one is round that very troubled topic, transport in Bristol, which has been the bugbear of every single political party in every single council administration for about 30 years. What had happened previously, that there'd been no discussion within the council between the three parties, or the four parties as they are now, about what the future is. They've agreed to establish some cross-party discussions to look at the troubled issues around rapid transit, around transport hubs, around trams and this sort of thing. And that's actually quite a significant concession, because there would be no proper discussion going on. So there's a couple of things. As far as we were concerned, PCSOs, police community support officers, what we've got is a guarantee from them that they are not going to attempt to cut any further funding this year, or to cut any further PCSOs in local communities, and a commitment that when we look at it on an annual basis, that local communities will be consulted about what they want to see from their community support officers. So they are the sort of, there's three key issues. Some of the other stuff was about the allocation of seats on committees, etc., which was going to happen anyway, but it was agreed between the three of us formally what would happen. So they're the sort of the main elements. There are one or two other bits and pieces that were included, but that was the best deal we can get. The only thing we didn't succeed on was the issue around Meals on Wheels. The Labour Party quite clearly opposed. There was a 30% increase in the price of Meals on Wheels for older people, which £9 a week was the effect of that. We couldn't get that reversed. We actually had a point blank refusal from the Liberal Democrats to even reconsider reducing that increase or doing away with it altogether. So that was very, very disappointing for us, and it's going to be vulnerable people in Bristol that will continue to suffer. And that's only the prospects for the future. We've got to find another £42 million worth of cuts over the next couple of years, so it's really going to be challenging.
Well, as you just said, we've now got four parties in the city. I mean, we had a Green councillor for a while, but we've got two now, which gives them their own little sort of department or office or whatever in the city council now. Don't you think that it's really a failure of the Labour Party to pick up this left-wing vote? That there's actually quite a lot environmentally that the Labour Party haven't been doing that's allowed the Greens to now get a foothold in Bristol. And I would imagine it's going to be, certainly if current trends are anything to go by, it's going to be eating into your vote for the at least certainly the next few years.
Well, it's actually quite interesting. The extra seat they got, the Greens got, actually was they took off the Liberal Democrats. That's an significant. In other places where they were challenges, they actually were defeated by the Labour Party. So that's just a factual matter. But very clearly, there are lots of issues upon which the Labour Party and the Greens take similar views. They're not the same. We're not the same. We don't take exactly the same views on that. And it's a challenge for us, very clearly, to make sure that we represent, if you like, I'll use the word green aspirations that people in communities have got. But certainly it's been the Labour Party that's led the campaign on the green issue of parks and open spaces. So I think that we've got some green credentials, but bluntly you're right that we do need to be working far harder on looking at, if you like, environmental sustainability issues and actually put that message across to people in Bristol.
And finally, before we start going through other bits of the news, what about the whole business of the Tesco's on Stokes Croft? Because this has been a massive issue for the city over Easter. And what are your thoughts on the rights and wrongs of Tesco and also of the policing of it over those two nights, Good Friday, just before Good Friday and the week after?
Well, the issue around Stokes Croft and Tesco's actually has been a great tragedy for Bristol as a whole. You know, scenes of that type of violence, whatever your initial view on it, does nothing either for the people in the Stokes Croft area or nothing for the reputation of Bristol. I think that's the first point. I think there is a debate around the role that large and major supermarkets play in their impact on local communities. There was a view amongst parts of the community around there that, if you like, planning consent should never have been given, and certainly Tesco's use of agents that sort of, if you like, disguise who it is, I think is really unfortunate, and they do need to think about stopping that practice in the future. But it's a very, very difficult issue. Nobody actually knows what, if you like, the entire local community feels around the issue. I'm a wholesale supporter of people's right to make protests. I'd be a hypocrite if I said that I wasn't. But, you know, the use of excessive violence, either by people making their point, is, I'm afraid, not acceptable. But neither is, shall we say, poor police policing of such events. And I think that the chief constable has admitted that there were some, shall we say, errors in the way that policing exercise was carried out. And I don't mind saying publicly that 9:30 at night, in circumstances where alcohol might have induced people to do things that they perhaps normally might not have get involved in, was a failure of police tactics. I'm not averse to, some people have suggested, for some sort of public inquiry in its widest context. I do think we need to look at the policing issues and the way that this situation has been allowed to develop. But the real tragedy is that there are a variety of interests in the Stokes Croft area, and there has been a great difficulty in actually getting people together to, how can I put it, engage with each other on a constructive basis to see if, bluntly, if the community can find a way forward, rather than having to rely on, if you like, the council or whomever else. Ultimately, it'll be the community that resolves this, and, you know, the use of some forms of violence, I think set that process actually back, rather than, you know, taking anything forward.
Martin Summers, you're an old Labour Oxford economist. Can you give us your view on the way that this has all panned out? The Bristol making it into the national news around the country over Easter, and who's right and who's wrong here? Should Tesco's have the right to set up there? Because there was actually quite a peaceful picket going on before these 140 riot police turned up.
There was. I think I generally agree with most of what Peter has just said. I think I'm probably a bit more critical of the policing, because there was a peaceful picket outside Tesco's, which has actually been very successful. And I know from speaking to some of those people that they were told by police from Trinity a couple of days before the trouble happened, that they were being leaned on to harass the peaceful protesters because they were being so successful. They said, we're not going to do that, but something is about to happen. And then, as Peter said, turning up at 9:30 on a bank holiday weekend evening with riot squads from out of town and, we understand, no fire truck, even though there was supposedly a petrol bomb in the squat. The police have got to prove that there was a petrol bomb in the squat. They haven't proved that yet. There is a suspicion out there in the community that the police at the highest level have been cooperating with Tesco's to become effectively Tesco's private army. And we know that the police in other parts of the country, you will tell me where, Tony, Tesco's have built a police station for the police, have they not?
Yes, up northwest, a £7 million police station. I can't remember, is it Doncaster?
Yeah, I mean, basically, Tesco should be taxed enough to pay for police stations. They shouldn't. There's always going to be a suspicion, if they're paying for police stations, that they are paying for policing. Now, I think this does. I think Greg Hoyt, who is the Green councillor for Ashley, has called for an inquiry. Kerry McCarthy, the Labour MP, was there most of the night. She saw a lot of what went on. I think for the sake of community peace, we need to get to the bottom of what happened, because it's actually very unusual for Bristol to have this kind of fracas. It's not the sort of thing that we normally expect to see.
I agree with you. It is extremely unusual. People were sort of comparing it with what happened in the 1980s. I don't think it was.
And I think in actual fact, there's always been a very good relationship between the community in East Bristol and Trinity. And I don't think, you know, and that, this is why people are a bit disturbed about riot police from South Wales, Devon, Cornwall and Wiltshire suddenly arriving on their doorstep armed to the teeth. That was not really appropriate.
Anyway, the editors at National Channel 4 News took to the whole business of the Tesco riots, if you want to call them that so seriously, that last night Siobhan Kennedy on Channel 4 News did a special report on the power of the supermarkets. And this is her conclusion. She was looking, one of the things she was looking at was planning. And this report starts with one of the spokespeople from the Town and Country Planning Association. Why are these supermarkets allowed to have their planning permission?
For many parts of the north of England and other parts of the United Kingdom, there is a kind of planning of desperation, where to get any development at all is seen to be so positive that you're willing basically to sign anything to get that development. You know, that is a problem that we need to deal with as well, in terms of creating equal opportunity across the nation.
Before the election, David Cameron championed local initiatives like this People's Supermarket in London. But his government has been clear the priority is now economic growth. The default answer to development should always be yes. So with the planning system moving in their favour, and with the high street still feeling the pain of the recession, in the future, supermarket expansion looks set to continue.
Now, Peter Hammond, leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, you're from Siobhan Kennedy's report there, it does sound like we've got more of this to come, because it's economics that are driving this, and all the economic muscle is in the hands of the big supermarkets, and particularly Tesco's.
I think that's a very reasonable conclusion, in fact, to draw. I mean, Tesco's, I think, is it the third largest, I think, retail organisation in the world, I think I saw quoted in one newspaper. So obviously it has great economic, could be argued potentially political power with a small p. There have been lots of, shall we say, representations and protests in local communities, not only in Stokes Croft, but I'm thinking of a particular development in Knowle, for example, where the local community was opposed to Tesco's building a similar type of installation in a former pub. They were given planning consent. I think there is a presumption in the planning process actually to give consent, so it's almost a system whereby you've got to show some particular reason why consent should be refused. And of course, if you don't get consent, you go to an appeal. And going to appeal is something that usually only very well-off individuals or organisations can actually even start the process of engaging. You or I probably couldn't afford to appeal against a planning application. So quite clearly the system is leans towards those with the money to be able to, if you like, take full advantage of what on paper seems to be potentially a fair system. It does on paper, but local communities quite clearly have a slightly different view about what they think. And refusing consent is actually quite a fraught fraught process for, you know, local councils, you know, if that's what they want to do.
But surely in the democracy it's not good enough just to say, well, I'm sorry, we can't do anything about it.
Well, that's the problem with the planning system. Even those people who sit on planning committees, you know, individual councillors, are under tremendous political pressure, with a small p, in what they can say and what things they can take into account on when they look at, you know, planning applications, even on small local ones or large ones. They too can find themselves open to challenge if they take certain action or take certain things actually into account. So it's a very difficult process, even for people, you know, people like me. Well, I'm not an expert in planning. I'm glad to say I've never sat on a planning committee in, you know, 30 odd years as a councillor. But it's very difficult, and the pressure actually is on the individuals in the meeting to actually produce a consistent and produce a, how can I put it, a decision that stands up if, you know, local communities don't want it. But don't run away with the view that all planning consents automatically will go through, because that's not true. But the system that we have at the moment, I think, needs a wholehearted review to try and make sure that, you know, local community views are reflected in whatever the outcome is.
Martin, can you see any way of injecting a little bit of democracy into this planning system that just says, well, if you've got the money, you can do what you want?
Well, I mean, you know, we live in a capitalist society, and, you know, the default position is that development should go ahead. I think with organisations like Tesco's, you've got to start looking at competition law, competition policy, the effect on local. I mean, it wasn't, I think it was believed it was in the Liberal Democrat manifesto that they were going to look at the local effects of competition, you know, local competition law. Because obviously what people are worried about if Tesco's in Stokes Croft is it's going to bump out the existing retailers who've been there for years and everybody knows. And are integrated into the community. And maybe we need to think about changing planning law. Not that we're in power to do it, but I mean, central government needs to start thinking about what sort of communities we want to have and what kind of powers local communities should have. The Conservatives talked about their localism bill, but at the other hand they're saying that the developers should always get their way. Some mistake, surely. They can't believe both things at once.
Well, you're talking about competition law, but actually Tesco's and these big supermarkets are far, far more powerful at a national level in lobbying for what they want. For example, back in the 1980s, Tesco's lobbied successfully to get rid of all the laws to do with maintaining prices, fixed prices for basic commodities such as milk and bread. And they got rid of the laws that said you've got to actually have a sensible price for that. And now, of course, what they do is when they go into an area, they can charge virtually nothing, have loss leaders for basic commodities such as bread and milk, in the knowledge that after maybe 6 months, a year and a half, all the local competition is going to be taken out, at which time they then raise their prices again.
Well, yes, I mean, that's what competition law ought to deal with, but doesn't.
Okay, well, on to our next story then. And council's disabled cuts have been ruled unlawful. And this is up in Birmingham. City Council in Birmingham, in a decision with widespread implications, the judges ruled cuts proposed by Birmingham Council were unlawful and cannot stand. The proposals were that only those whose needs had been assessed as critical would qualify for council-funded care. But Mr Justice Walker said there had been a failure to take proper account of the duty to promote equality under laws of disability and discrimination. The judge also ruled the consultation process in Birmingham City Council was flawed. Now, this Birmingham's quite famous, actually, just north of us, of being in the forefront of the cuts. They've cut a massive amounts from their budget, and they're now also telling a lot of disabled people that they don't have any statutory duty to look after them anymore. Well, what are your thoughts on this story, Peter?
Well, I actually think the judge made the right decision. Because quite clearly what's happened is, you know, vulnerable people, and by the way, to be categorised as there's a grading system, and it goes up top two, a substantial and critical, you know, to attack people at this particular level of need, I think is absolutely appalling. And I think generally, you know, the judge has made the right decision to defend the rights of these particular people. But of course the real problem is that Birmingham Council has got, you know, is their budget is capped. So if they're going to be able to bring about, you know, the proper level of care for this particular group, somebody else, somewhere else in the council, is going to have to pay the price of doing that. And one of the interesting debates, you know, I actually disagree with the national leader of my party on this when he talks about the effects of cuts affecting the squeezed middle. I actually think it's the squeezed majority that these things are actually going to affect. And what's happened is that local councillors are being reduced simply to the agents of national government. As you know, as we've said, so much for the localism bill. There is no local discretion now in the sense of determining the level of service. You're given a lump of money, crudely speaking, and told that's it and get on with it.
Well, you're almost making an argument there for us not to be bothering to vote for you, Peter.
Well, I don't think if you don't vote, what's the saying? If you don't vote, the government wins, whoever the government happens to be. But quite clearly, you know, at the moment it's an issue about choices, and Birmingham made this choice, and the legal opinion is that that's the wrong choice that was in fact made. And I think it's appalling the way that people have been, you know, singled out for this type of, you know, reduction.
And it's not just in Birmingham that disabled people are getting hit here. A disabled man, this is in yesterday's Independent, was under court protection, but he was still evicted. A disabled man who's supposedly being protected by the courts was wandering homeless yesterday after bailiffs used sledgehammers to evict him from his home. Les Gilliland, 42, said that he had no warning of their arrival because a court has ruled that he's not competent to look after himself. When the Independent tracked him down, he was in a Bristol Kettery trying to arrange a safe home for his four cats, having no idea where he would be spending the night. His case has been taken up by campaigning Lib Dem MP John Hemming, who says it illustrates serious flaws in the way the legal system deals with people who are judged to be unable to manage their own affairs. So I imagine that this poor disabled chap, Lee Martin Summers, is in Bristol now, possibly sleeping rough or looking for somewhere to stay. But even though he's disabled, he's still been evicted at the point of a sledgehammer. What are your thoughts on this particular story?
Well, it's appalling, frankly. It's just appalling. But it's, again, we're going to hear more and more of this, aren't we, as we go forward. And what makes my blood boil is that the bonuses in the City of London are still being paid out. There's a high pay report brought out by Compass recently that shows that the top 1% have got the biggest slice of the national cake they've had since 1900. Meanwhile, disabled people are being thrown on the streets. This is the kind of situation we've got ourselves into.
Peter, isn't this sort of inevitable, though, with the cuts, that some of the services and the special privileges that are given to the poorest in society and people who are vulnerable are just simply going to have to slip back?
Well, of course, first of all, they're not privileges. They're, you know, they're entitlements that, you know, people with disabilities and, so we say, some of the poorest and most vulnerable people are entitled to. Of course, this is a tragic story, both for the individual, but it's also tied up with bureaucracy, that the bureaucracy prevented this poor guy from actually even being aware of what was likely to happen to him. And if he'd have been aware, and if you like, the bureaucracy had been right, actually it probably could have been prevented. And it's an absolute tragedy. It's actually disgusting that this type of activity has happened to this poor guy. But, you know, it's right. This is going to happen increasingly across not only Bristol or anywhere like that, but across the country. It's appalling.
Bristol police confirmed yesterday that they were called to observe while bailiffs carried out a High Court order to take possession of Mr Gilliland's home. Our role was purely to prevent a breach of the peace, a spokesman for Avon and Somerset Police said. Mr Gilliland's solicitor was not available for comment yesterday. A spokesman for the official solicitor said, "We do not comment on individual cases." And I'm joined in the studio by Marina Morris. Marina, what have you got for us this week?
Hello. Social immobility. This month, the Prince's Trust have published a report called Broke Not Broken, Tackling Youth Poverty and the Aspiration Gap. According to Professor David Blanchflower, it highlights the urgent needs to tackle social immobility in the UK. There is an ambitious crisis among our poorest young people, causing thousands to lose faith in their own abilities and aspiration. These feelings of hopelessness are often passed down from generation to generation and can spread throughout our most deprived communities. It investigates the impact of youth poverty on young people's aspiration and self-beliefs hidden within unemployment statistics. There is a clear gap in the aspiration of the UK's richest and poorest young people. Young people growing up in poverty are significantly less likely to believe their life and career goals are achievable. 22% of youngsters from deprived homes believe that few or none of their goals in life are achievable, compared to just 5% of those from affluent families. 26% of young people growing up in poverty believe that few or none of their career goals are achievable, compared to just 7% of those from wealthy families. 26% of young people from poor homes feel that people like them don't succeed in life. 24% of young people from deprived homes believe they end up on benefits for at least part of their life, and more than one in five feel they will end up in the debt and job. 16% of young people from poor homes say their family and friends have made fun of them when they talk about finding a good job. 10% of young people from the UK's poorest families did not have their own bed when they were growing up. How does society unleash their latent potential and transform the life of most vulnerable young people? Society would be much more successful and better. What personal price for the broken dreams are the young paying today? And what will be a damaged society cost the country in the future? As Britain population continue to age, the youth of today will be supporting the elderly of tomorrow. The well-being, aspiration and even health of young will be deeply affected by prolonged unemployment. There is a strong relation between social and health problems. Major depression is the number one psychological disorder in the Western world. It is growing in all age groups, in virtually every community, and the growth is seen most in the young, especially teens. At the rate of increase, it will be the second most disabling condition in the world by 2020, behind heart disease. From April 2011, National Statistics attempted to measure national happiness. But we must be ready for the evidence of even growing list of social problems as a consequence of the social immobility and ambition crisis, including drugs, alcohol, violence, depression, that all make society increasingly dysfunctional. More equal society have more ambition youngsters and less social problems.
Thanks very much, Marina. And I'm joined by Peter Hammond, who's the Labour leader on Bristol City Council. Now, this is pretty depressing stuff. I mean, what Marina's just been talking about depression as a major problem. And we're just starting, it seems now, nationally, to start measuring national happiness. Isn't that a little bit of a misnomer? Why are we doing measuring national happiness when depression is actually becoming a really serious problem around us, and youth poverty and homelessness amongst the young particularly?
Well, you know, in one sense, that a lot of academic work is actually telling us something that, you know, those of us who work in the community and part of the community have known, if you like, without a theoretical basis to back it up. And over the next few years, this is actually going to accelerate, because very clearly what is happening, both, you know, as a result of government action and a result of what some local councils are actually following through, is going to make this situation absolutely worse and worse and worse. And it's very difficult. It's depressing even to think about.
You're starting to depress me as well. But Peter, I'm afraid we're in a situation where we're having to make these cuts around the country because of the rather bad accounting that was done under New Labour and under Gordon Brown's previous government.
Well, you know, we have this long-running debate and argument that the Conservatives appear to reel out every time anybody criticises anything.
Well, that wasn't the Conservatives, that's me. And a lot of people out there think that. Yeah, so that actually we've been left in this situation by Labour overspending in the past.
Well, if you look at the level of spending that the Labour government took out and carried through until the bankers crash, in fact, the level of debt was actually significantly lower than many other countries. This is the truth. It's not just made up. And it's actually the activities of the bankers that caused the crash, the practices, etc., which were accelerated and began as a result of financial activities in the United States accelerated across the world, and actually revealed the activities of bankers, etc. And it's being compounded at the moment by the actions of speculators on the commodity markets at this particular point in time. I was looking at something about coffee, all right, not an absolute essential for everybody, but the price of coffee is... the high price of coffee is not actually due to a shortage of coffee, it's actually due to the activities of currency and commodity speculators at this point in time, who are making billions out of their, so say, trading activities, etc. So it is a serious problem, but where we've got to it is an issue. But one minor thing is just about debt. I've got a mortgage. And if I did the same sort of calculation probably on my mortgage in terms of the repayments that you'd make, I'd probably, if I grossed it up, I'd probably reach similar figures, if you like, in terms of the, so say, national debt and repayments. What the problem is, we have to reduce what we're expending, but to cram it all into 1 or 2 years is lunacy, and actually will stop us being able to work our way out of the recession that basically we're suffering at the moment. But it'll actually destroy the economic base for actually rebuilding the future.
But in the recent anti-cuts march in London that were organised by the trade the TUC and the little trade unionists and other people from around the country gathered, your leader, Ed Miliband, was saying actually we do need cuts, just not quite so many.
Yes, that's absolutely true, and it was always... the plan of the last Labour government to introduce some reductions and some cuts in expenditure. There's no point in pretending that's not the case. But the argument actually is what you're doing now is damaging any future prospects. You're destroying the public service. You're actually destroying the economic base from which economic recovery can take place. That's really, in fact, what is happening. You're destroying people's incomes and people's ability, if you like, themselves to contribute to making life better for themselves and for the economy in the future.
Martin Summers, Old Labour, Oxford economist. What's your take on all this? Do we actually need cuts? I know you've said in the past you don't think we do.
No, I don't think we do, actually. And I think what will happen as we go forward is that the deficit is going to increase as a result of the frankly idiotic policies being pursued by the Conservative front bench. But once you've actually crashed the economy, you don't talk about more cuts. I mean, they're at this position in Ireland, in Portugal, in Spain. Once you've reached the end of the road, you can't cut anymore. You have to invest. Now, you've got to have fiscal consolidation. You can't just spend your way out. But that means you've got to look at the distribution of wealth in the society.
Well, what do you mean by fiscal consolidation?
You can't just spend money that you haven't got. You can spend some money you haven't got, and that's what you should do in a recession. As anybody who I used to teach A-level economics, that's a standard thing that you would do, is you have some deficit, but you can't have too much of a deficit, because then you lose your credit rating, as is going to happen to the Conservative government. They're going to lose their credit rating. The bond market are already looking at them saying your cuts are going to increase the deficit, we're going to mark down your credit rating. When that happens, it's going to be like Black Wednesday when the pound was forced out of the ERM. The intellectual basis for their policy will collapse. I do agree with Peter that you probably could cut something and still survive, but I don't think that's actually the policy that needs to be pursued. I think further down the road, the Labour front bench, Ed Balls and people of that calibre will look at this and say, Danny Blanchflower's report we just heard from, he used to be at the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England. Ultimately, once you've crashed the economy, and we're going to get there, like Ireland, like Portugal, like Spain, you don't cut anymore. You stop cutting. You have to actually look around and say, actually, we've got plenty of money in this society. It's in the hands of too few people. We need wealth taxes. Land value taxation, for example. Andy Burnham, quite a good Blairite, he said we've got to look at land value taxation. We've got to start looking at getting the money off the wealthy classes and reinvesting in the society. In the 1950s, when the Conservatives ran the country, the top rate of tax was 96%. That's when the boys were fighting in Korea.
Okay, well, on to our story about super injunctions this week, and I have to be very, very careful. I'm not sure what I'm allowed to say and what I'm not allowed to say, but we've had a partial lifting of a super injunction on Fred Goodwin, and also there's quite a good article in the Telegraph which is talking about some of these super injunctions. Parts of them have been leaked, but we're not allowed to name, and it's not actually public who the people are involved. Others have been. I can just go through a few which have been exposed. Sir Fred Goodwin, disgraced former head of the Royal Bank of Scotland, took out a super injunction to stop people writing about an alleged relationship with a senior colleague. The reason that that was in the public interest, apparently, was because actually he wasn't supposed to be having a relationship with someone else on the board of the same bank, potentially. Lord Stoneham of Droxford, a Lib Dem peer, told the House of Lords under the protection of parliamentary privilege all about this on the 19th of May earlier this week. David Beckham, former England star, failed to get an injunction to stop Rebecca Lewes talking about an alleged affair in 2004. BBC broadcaster Andrew Marr voluntarily dropped an injunction which prevented reports of his affair with a fellow journalist in 2003. And the former Blackburn footballer Gary Fitcroft, who's married, lost a battle to keep an affair with the lap dancer private. Now, Peter Hammond, leader of the Labour Group on the Bristol City Council, what is your what are your thoughts about these super injunctions? Because it all started with this Trafigura one, which The Guardian was reporting on, about a company who managed to get an injunction saying there was no going to be no reporting of toxic waste that it was dumping in Africa.
Well, this is all about money, isn't it? And it's fed by the role of large parts of the media in search of, you know, scandal and excitement, etc. You've got this toxic mix now. And a ridiculous situation, whereas if, you know, if I was a member of parliament, if I said something in here that, you know, broke an injunction, I could be, you know, sued and pursued. But I can, if I, you know, walk 100 yards down the road so as to speak and walk into parliament, I can say what you like. And actually, if it's televised live, everybody else will know the information. But you've got a ridiculous situation. But if you put it down in writing, the same information, you're breaking an injunction. It's all about money, and all of these cases are about the ability of individuals to use their wealth and their resources to prevent the revealing, not only of, if you like, potential sexual scandals, but the case that you first mentioned is the serious thing, which is about the activities of business in attempting to conceal wrongdoing, serious wrongdoing, in order that they can not face penalties. And I actually think that's the heart of the problem.
But where are we going to go with the balance between privacy on the one hand and free speech on the other, then?
That's going to be very difficult to judge. You know, the exercise of free speech, you know, may become to be only exercisable by some people, and the right to privacy is only going to be exercisable by some people. It'll still remain there on paper, if you like, your human rights, but it will be money that determines which particular part of, if you like, the human rights mix benefits you or doesn't benefit you. I'm not sure where this is going to end up, but I suspect it may, the whole super injunction thing may practically collapse as a result of a voluntary people such as Andrew Marr, but certainly as a result of, you know, television televising, you know, people in Parliament. I suspect that there's going to be a lot more people now using the parliamentary route to potentially reveal, if you like, the contents of these injunctions. And if that's live, you can't stop it.
One of the things I think is that, I mean, this super injunction thing seems to have turned logic on its head, where you've got the rich and powerful, who the press need to be scrutinising, using the courts to stop them, whereas everybody else that doesn't have the wealth and power, the press can scrutinise them, find and write anything about them that they want to, so long as it's backable, at least it's true, and that they're prepared to take them on in the courts, because, you know, people who don't have a lot of money can't fight libel cases, etc., against these big newspapers. Martin Summers, is that the case, do you think, that actually what we've got here is two levels of privacy, one for the people who are rich and powerful and in positions where the press should be scrutinising, and one for everybody else?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you a little story. I was teaching in a school in Fulham in West London, and the Sun sent somebody to our nativity play, and it was actually, the nativity play was a Caribbean Christmas, because it was a multiracial area, so we had a Caribbean Christmas. And the next day in the Sun it said, parents storm out of politically correct nativity play, which didn't happen. Nobody stormed out. It was a completely made up story. But could we get any retraction from the Sun? No retraction at all. We had no comeback whatsoever. So everybody else in the country believed that people had stormed out of our nativity play. In fact, no such thing had happened. It was basically made up lies, but no comeback whatsoever. And I've got no, in a way, no sympathy for the wealthy and powerful, but I would point this out. I'm not really interested who they're having sex with. I think that people's prurient interest in the sex lives of the rich and famous reflects rather badly on them. And I think, despite what's happened with Dominique Strauss-Kahn in New York over the last week, I think the French policy of letting private lives be private is actually quite a good one, because it means that politicians can actually get on and be politicians without wondering all the time, looking over their shoulders. Because everybody's got peccadilloes, and people should be allowed a private life, especially if they're in politics.
Well, you think that everybody in politics has got skeletons in the closet, then?
It's not unusual. I mean, Lloyd George had plenty of mistresses, but nobody talked about them in the newspaper in those days.
Surely there's a legitimate concern that someone's sexual infidelity may be connected to their corruption.
Only if they are family values politicians and they've made a deal out of family values. Then they're fair game. But otherwise, they're not in my view.
Well, another censorship-style issue this week has been over this new film, which has just come out, which we mentioned briefly last week, and it's called Unlawful Killing. So let's have a little listen to a little extract from that, because the director of it, this is all about the death of Princess Diana, financed by Dodie Fayed, but it's a film that we won't be seeing or hearing. Well, we will be hearing it in a minute, but we won't be seeing it here on the TVs in Britain, because it's not going to be allowed to be shown. You have to watch it up on the internet, I imagine, or get a DVD from France or something like that if you want to see it. But here's a quick preview now, and the voice you can hear is that of the director, Keith Allen.
You've got the ultimate cocktail of danger for the British establishment.
Look, I just have to explain to you that I didn't find this film very difficult to make. The film virtually made itself because of what was being revealed in the inquest. I thought it was important that the public got to understand in a forensic manner what was happening in this inquest. And I didn't want to make a sensationalist film. I don't think it is a sensationalist film. I think it is a very forensic analysis of a process, a British legal process. It reveals certain things that, I'm sorry, don't add up, and I believe that they should be questioned. That's why I made the film, and in essence, that's what the film is about.
How is it that every single traffic camera in that tunnel was switched off for not working?
Historically, the relationship between the Royal Family and the courts has been difficult. Mainly because every judge has taken an oath of allegiance to the Queen.
Let me make this absolutely clear. This is not an attack on the monarchy. It's actually questioning the role of the establishment. I don't understand at which point in the film I would have said to the viewers, by the way, this was financed by Mr. Al-Fayed. And I think it may have interrupted a flow of thought, so there's no point. I think you'll find that there are an immense number of films coming out of America and all over the world that are financed by the Mafia, and there's no reference to those, so, you know.
The British establishment think that they have got away with murder, but then what's new? They've been getting away with murder for centuries.
I don't think many people would want me to be Queen, actually. When I say many people, I mean the establishment that I'm married into.
That was Keith Allen's new film, Unlawful Killing, discussed there at Cannes earlier this week, and the director, Keith Allen, speaking. Martin Summers, we did discuss this briefly last week. Is that true, what Keith is saying, that the British establishment have been killing people for centuries?
Well, it's hardly disputable, is it? Let's face it. The Empire was not a Sunday afternoon tea party.
And do you think that this film should be shown?
Well, it's going to be shown, isn't it, factually?
Not in Britain, apparently.
Well, we can get it all on the internet anyway. So all of these kind of controls that there used to be on the mainstream media, we now have alternative media. If anybody's interested in this film, they will see it, and there won't be nobody will be able to stop them.
Peter, what are your thoughts on this particular film and this whole issue of censorship now? Because there's all sorts of reasons, legal reasons, being given why we won't be able to see this on our televisions here.
Well, there used to be the old D-notice system, allegedly around security issues, which was a voluntary system that the press themselves used to follow. It's very difficult to comment. The old stories about stuff that we never saw in this country, if you bought it in Paris, in a French magazine.
In a word, will you be watching it on the internet or not?
I don't know, really, is my honest answer. I've never given much thought to the particular film.
Okay, well, that's all for our news review. So we're coming up now to the time for the Sky News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest. You just heard there, new councillor for St George West, just crowned leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Peter Hammond. After the news, we do a tour around the Middle East and look at conflicts around the world, as well as look at the railway bill, or not railway bill, railway report, which came out last week, with BCFM Steve Satan. After the news.
Community radio station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Britain.